You are listening to the Live from Irish Arts Centre podcast, bringing you closer to live Irish arts in New York City. For more information, visit irishartscentre.org.
The Irish writer Kevin Barry's best short stories are like a spade to the face. This is the start of a review in The Guardian of Barry's collection Dark Lies the Island. It's an assortment of darkly comical tales he was nice enough to share with us here at the Irish Arts Centre back in the fall of 2013. Here, he reads from the story Fjord of Killary and a short excerpt from his award-winning novel, City of Bohan. And if you like what you hear, there's good news. Kevin Barry will be back, swinging spades and discussing his newest novel, Beetlebone, at the IAC on November 16th. For more information or to purchase tickets, visit irishartscenter.org. And now, a spade to the face.
And thanks for having me at this place. It's my first time at the Arts Centre, so it's a real buzz to read here for you. I'm going to read the opening bit of a short story, and then I'm going to skip the middle bit, and then I'm going to read the end bit. And I'm kind of worried that we won't miss very much at all, really. but we'll see how we get on. This is a story about a poet who tires of what he calls the sex heat of cities and moves out to the western seaboard, out to County Galway, to a place called the Fjord of Killary. And actually, when I should point out, no actual Irish poets were hurt during the making of this story. But I just after it came out in the New Yorker, and I was thrilled, and I met an actual Irish poet on the street in Galway City, Dennis O'Driscoll. And he said, oh, I read that story, very good, very funny, and it had been out about an hour and a half, but he had read everything, you know. And I said, thanks, Dennis, but I have one qualm. I was wondering, would an Irish poet really have the wherewithal to buy a hotel, you know? And he said, don't underestimate us. So with apologies in advance for the appalling language, I'll read from Fjord of Killary. So I bought an old hotel out on the Fjord of Killary. It was set hard by the harbour wall, with Whale Ray Mountain across the water and disgracefully grey skies above. It rained 297 days of the year, and the locals were given to magnificent mood swings. The night in question, the rain was especially violent. It came down like handfuls of nails flung hard and fast by a seriously riled sky god. I was at this point 8 months in the place and about convinced it would be the death of me. It's end of the fucking world stuff out there, I said. The chorus of locals in the hotel's lounge bar, as always, ignored me. I was a fretful blow-in by their mark and simply not cut out for tough, gnarly West of Ireland living. They were listening instead to John Murphy, our alcoholic funeral director. I'll bury anything that fucking moves, he said. Bastard suicide stinkers, he said. I couldn't give a fucking monkeys, he said. And Whale Ray is the most depressing mountain you've ever seen, by the way. And its gaunt, looming shape filled every view from the Water's Edge Hotel, the lounge bars included. The locals drank mostly Bushmills whiskey and Guinness stout, and they drank them to great excess. I wiped their slops from the counter with a bar cloth I had come to hate with a passion that verged on insane. I said, but seriously, that's one motherfucker of a high tide out there, no? Barely the toss of a glance I received. The bar talk had shifted to roads, mileage, and general directions. They made a geography of the country by the naming of pubs. Do you know Madigan's in Maynooth? I do, of course. You take a left there. I have you now. The hotel had 23 bedrooms and it listed westward. Set a can of peas on the floor of just about any bedroom and it would roll slowly in the direction of the gibbering Atlantic. The estate agent had gussied up the history of the place in the brochure. A traditional coaching inn, original beams, visited by Thackeray, heritage bleeding out the wazoo. And I had leapt at it. I was the last of the hopeless romantics. The bar talk moved on, briefly, from roads and directions. "If he's still around when her bandages come off," Bill Knott, the surveyor, said, "he's a braver man than me." "She's a nice woman," John Murphy agreed, "as long as you don't put your hand in the cage." Behind the bar, the Guinness tap, the Smiddix tap, the lager taps, the line of optics, the neatly stacked rows of glasses and a high stool by a wee slit window with a view across the water towards Moelre. The iodine tang of kelp hung in the air always and put me in mind cheerfully of embalming fluid. Bill Knott looked vaguely from his bushmills out to the water. "Hi-ish all right," he said. "But now what would we be talking about for Belmullet, would you say? Off a slow road?" The primary interest of these people's lives, it seemed to me, was how far one place was from another and how long it might take to complete the journey, given the state of the roads. Bill had been in haulage as a young man, considered himself expert. "I don't know, Bill," I said. "Would we say 1 hour and 20 if you hadn't tailbacked out of Newport?" I said, "I really don't fucking well know, Bill." "There are those who'd say you'll do it in the hour," he sipped delicately. "But you'd want to be grease fucking lightning coming up out of Westport, wouldn't you?" "We could be swimming a jet, Bill," I said. I had made, despite it all, a mild success of myself in life. But on turning 40, the previous year, I sensed exhaustion rising up in me like rot. I found that to be alone with work all day was increasingly difficult, and the city had become a jag on my nerves. The brochure about the hotel appeared in my life like a revelation. I clutched it in my hands for days on end. I grew feverish with the notion of a westward flight. I lay in bed with the brochure as the city throbbed outside, and I moaned as I read aloud, "Original beams, traditional coaching inn, Thackeray, established 1648. The hotel had the promise of an ideal solution. I could distract myself from myself with its day-to-day running, its endless little errands, and perhaps late at night or early in the morning, I would continue at some less intense level with the poetry. All my friends, every last one of them, said, "The Shining." But I was thinking, "The west of Ireland, the murmurous ocean, the rocky hills hard-founded in a greenish light, the cleansing air, the little stoats peeping shyly from gaps in the dry stone walls. It would all do to make a new man of me." Of course, I hadn't counted on having to listen to my summer staff, a pack of energetic young Belarusians, fucking each other at all angles of the clock. And the ocean turned out to gibber rather than murmur. Gibber, gibber, hush. Gibber, gibber, hush. Down the far end of the bar, Mick Harty, distributor of bull semen for the vicinity, was molesting his enormously fat wife, Vivian. "But after a meal at the place run by the Dutch f***s," he said, "we'd oysters for a starter, then we gone fucking bananas." Vivian slapped and roared at him as he stroked her massive haunches. She reddened and chortled as he twisted her around and pulled her vast rear side towards his crotch area. Nobody apart from me paid a blind bit of attention to the spectacle. And even as she suffered a pretend butt rape from her cackling husband, she turned to me and informed me precisely what they were after paying for the meal at the Dutch couple's restaurant. "We had 2 starters, 2 mains. We shared a dessert, 2 bottles of wine, 2 cappuccinos, she said, as Mick grinded slowly behind, hoarsely yodeling an Alicia Keys love ballad. €136 even, not cheap, Quivine. "Cappuccino's a breakfast drink," I said. You're not supposed to drink it after a meal. I was not well liked out in Killary. I was considered superior. Of course, I was fucking superior. I ate at least 5 portions of fruit and veg daily. I had omega-3 from oily fish coming out my ears. I limited myself strictly to 21 units of alcohol a week. I hadn't written 2 consecutive lines of a fucking poem in 8 months flat. I was becoming versed instead in the strange illicit practices of the hill country. The fuckers are washing diesel up there again, John Murphy said. The Howrigans. Of course, they'd a father a diesel washer before them, didn't they? Cunts, their men. Cunts, Bill Knott confirmed. Outside, the rain continued to hammer away at our dismal little world, and the sky had shocked the last of its evening to grey, and it took on an intense purple tone that was ominous, close in, biblical. John Murphy grabbed my elbow as I passed along the bar. He was aggressive always once the third pint was down, and he said, I suppose you know that that possessed fucking she-devil above in the house is going to put me in the ground. John, I said, I really don't want to hear about it. I mean, literally, Queeveen, she's going to fucking do for me. John, I said, your marriage is your own private business. She's fucking poisoning me. I swear to bleeding fucking Jesus, I can taste it off the tea, Queeve. Would you go again, John? I indicated his empty stout glass. Oh, please, he said. They're all nutjobs. This is what it came down to. This is the thing you learn about habitual country drinkers. Nutjobs. Mick Harty, said Vivian Harty, mix a man of 60. She was awed at the persistence of her husband's desire, and he'd still get up on a cracked fucking plate. Just then, a cacophony erupted. From the hillsides everywhere came the aggravated howling of dogs. These were amped to an unnatural degree. The talk in the bar stalled for a moment in response, but as abruptly it resumed. The tiramisu, Mick Harty said. You wouldn't know whether to eat it or smear it all over yourself. Nadia, one of my Belarusians, came through from the supper room and sullenly collected some glasses. The arse on that, John Murphy said. Please, John, I said. Like 2 apples in a hanky, he said. I believed all 9 of my summer staff were in varying degrees of sexual contact with one another. I housed them in the dreary, viewless rooms at the back of the hotel where I myself lived during what I will laughably describe as high season. And my sleepless nights were filled with the sound of their rotating passions. Thank you, Nadia, I said. She scowled at me as she placed the dishes in the dishwasher. I was not allowed to forget I was paying minimum wage. The dogs had stopped. The rain continued, and it was by now an hysterical downpour, with great sheets of water streaming down from Whale Ray, and the harbour roared in the fattening light. Visibility was reduced to 14 feet in front of our faces. This all signalled that the West of Ireland holiday season had begun. Now, we're going to skip the middle bit of the story, but all you're missing is the rain keeps coming down. The waters keep rising and they start drinking quicker, okay? And we'll just go into the last couple of pages. The worst of the news was that the emergency appeared to be localised. The fjord of Killary was flooding when no other place was flooding. I felt that the worst possible course would be to close the bar. There was a kind of hilarity to the proceedings still, and this would not be maintained if I stopped serving booze. The pace of the drinking, if anything, quickened. Now that the waters of Killary were rising, you'd never know when you were going to lift your last. Would we want to be making sout? Mick Harty wondered. Vivian rubbed his wrist so tenderly, I found myself welling up. Hush now, she said. Hush now, babes.
If we went up past Loch Fee, Bill Knott said, and we swung around the far side, we'd nearly make it to the N59.
The Belarusians carted boxloads of old curtains from the attic to use as sops against the doorways. But the moment the last boxload reached the bottom of the stairs, the doors popped and the waters of Killary entered my old hotel. I moved everybody upstairs. There was a function room up there that I used for the occasional wedding. It had a fully stocked bar and operational disco lights. We weren't a moment too soon. As I trailed up the stairs, keeping to the rear of all my locals and Belarusians, I cast an eye back over my shoulder. It had the look of death's dateless night back there. Hop, people, I cried. For Jesus' sake, hop. More calls were made on mobiles. We were promised the emergency services were being moved out. I turned off the harsh strip lighting overhead and switched to the mood lighting, which moved in lovely, dreamy disco swirls. Even yet, the rain hammered down on my old hotel at Killary. I opened the bar and the locals were not shy about stepping up to it. We drank. We whispered. We laughed like cats. Bill Knott reckoned the distance to Clare Island, oversea, if it should come to it. And of course, it would not be the first time he said that the likes of us were sent hopping for the boats. Vivian Harty whispered to Janie McAllister. Janie's colour was returning with frequent nips of my brandy. Vivian swirled it in the glass and fed it to the old lady, her tiny grey head she cradled on a vast lap. Thackeray, on visiting the backwoods of Ireland, bemoaned the choking peat smoke and the obstreperous cider and the diet of raw ducks and raw peas and also a particular inn. No pen can describe that establishment, he said, as no English imagination could have conceived it. John Murphy told us very loudly that he still loved his wife. She still excites me, he said. It's been 28 years, and I still get a horn on me when I see that bitch climb a stairs. I went to the landing outside the function room. I looked down the road. It was by now a waterway. The hotel porch had disappeared, and dozens of cormorants were approaching in formation across the water. It was like the fucking attack on Dresden. I rushed back to the function room just as the cormorants landed on the kitchen roof out back, and a weeping Mick Harty was confessing to Vivian Harty an affair of 15 years standing with her sister. All the old filth starts to come out, Alan Fettle said. Vivian approached her husband and embraced him and planted a light kiss on his neck as they held each other against the darkness. Then she bit him on the neck. Blood came in great, angry spurts. I vomited briefly, and I decided to put on some music. I looked out the landing window as I dashed along the corridor to get some CDs from my room. This was a very bad move. Seven sheep in a rowing boat were bobbing about on the waters of Killary. The sheep appeared strangely calm. I picked lots of old familiars. ABBA, The Pretenders, Bryan Adams. I pelted back to the function room. We're here, I cried. We might as well have a disco. Oh, and we danced the night away out on the fjord of Killary. We danced to Chiquitita, slowly and sensuously. We danced in great wet-eyed nostalgia to Brass and Pocket, and we had all the old steps still, as if 1979 was only yesterday. We punched the air madly to Summer of 69. I went out the landing to find the six Belarusians sitting on top of the stairs. The waters of Killary were halfway up the stairs. Footstools sailed by, placemats, phone books, toilet rolls, but what could I do? I went back to the function room and served out pints hand over fist. All mobile signals were now down. There appeared on the horizon no saviours in high-vis clothing. The waters were rising yet, and the view was suddenly clear to me. The world opened out to its grim beyonds, and I realised that at 40, one must learn the rigours of acceptance. Capitalise it. Acceptance. I needed to accept what was put before me, be it a watery grave in Ireland's only natural fjord, or a return to the city in its greyer intensities, or a wordless exile in some steaming Cambodian swamp hole, or poems or no poems, or children or not, lovers or not, illness or otherwise, success or its absence, I would accept all that was put in my way from here on true until I breathed my last. Electrified, I searched for a notebook. Bill Knott danced. John Murphy danced. The McAllisters and the Fettles waltzed. The Belarusians dry-humped one another in the function room's darker corners. The Harties were in a deep emotional conversation in a booth. Mick held to his bleeding neck a wad of napkins. I myself took to the dance floor, swiveled slowly on my feet and closed my eyes against the lights. "You enjoying yourselves, lads?" I called, and I felt I was growing into the mine host role. I ran out to the landing for a spot check on the flood, and I was met there by Alexei, the wall-eyed Belarusian. He indicated, with a happy jerk of his thumb, the water level on the stair. It had dropped a couple of steps. I patted his back and winked just the once, and I returned to the disco. 1648 was a year shy of Cromwell's landing in Ireland, and already the inn at Killary Fjord was in business. It would see out this disaster too. Now random phrases and images came at me, the sudden quick-fire assaults that signal a new idea, and I knew that they would come in sequence soon enough. Their predestined rhythms would assert. I felt a new, quiet ecstasy take hold. The gloom of youth had at last lifted. Thank you very much. Thanks.
Okay, I'm going to read. I'm not even going to try explain what's going on. It's the middle of the 21st century in Bohan, and there are all sorts of gang fights happening. And the main gang, the Hartnett Fancy, is about to go into battle in a chapter that's simply titled Feud. The Hartnett Fancy was mobbed beneath its colours out to Smoketown Dune End. It was first dark of the longest night. The Fancy was edgy. The hot charge of adrenaline rushed, mitts were flexed, knuckles cracked, jaws clenched, and the ranked banners in the wind's assault made an ominous rattling. The purple and black of the banners had an ecclesiastical look, neo-Romish, and upon the banners were daubed symbols and slogan of the Backtrace Fancy. Symbols: a puckcoat's head, a scimitar dirk, a dogstar moon, slogan, throat or vengeance. S-Town was agog, and freaky-eyed whores amped on few juice shrieked their X-rated tributes to the Fancy Boys from the high windows. The Fancy Boys waved back to the whores and attempted a semblance, at least, of blithe spirit. Among the Fancy, as was remarked, with awe and suspicion, in the S-Town grog pits and herb parlours, the fearsome sandpikies now were mingled. Sandpikies had about them the calmest of airs. They shook out their limbs and performed calisthenic stretches and tossed their hatchets for show in the air and caught them again behind the backs and filled repeatedly their neck pipes with bead-sized nodges of blackest hashish sucked deeply on the fill. These were the dreadlock assassins of the Bohan Dune system. Fancy regulars and sandpikey buy-ins were of a number combined that would be a match put just for the eight families of Northside aggravators roistering across river in the Bohan Trace. Logan Hartnett, princely outlaw, suavely walked the ranks and offered his smiles and whispers of encouragement. There was confidence to be read in the sly pursing of his lips, and atop a most elegant cut of an Italian suit, he wore ceremonially an oyster grey top hat. Mothers and sisters and lovers of the Fancy Boys meantime passed through the mob, shedding tears and sweet Baba J medals as they went. The medals were for protection. Fokker Burke, primo Fancy lieutenant, was bouncing about as though on springs, and he hissed his encouragement to the Fancy, and he kept on an extendable battle leash his Alsatian love, Angie, who pranced and drooled and whose eye gleam gave back the glow of December moon. Fokker was bare-armed beneath a denim waistcoat and wore his finest brass-toed bobber boots, and he felt a racing currents of pride, emotion, fear. Angie had been kept 3 days without a feed. Ginny Ching, primo Fancy lieutenant, pinballed about the assembled mob and screamed crazy Mandarin curses. Ginny Ching carried a spike ball on a chain and swung it above her head. She wore an all-in-one black nylon jumpsuit, so tightly fitted it might have been applied with a spray can, and she smoked a black cheroot to match, and her mouth was a hard slash of crimson lippy. Wolfie Stanner's primo Fancy lieutenant, however, was widely acknowledged to have taken the fashion prize. Wolfie was dressed to kill in an electric blue ska suit, white vinyl brothel creepers with steel toe caps inlaid, four scalp blades readied on a custom-made crossbelt. He danced among the ranks of the fancy and eyeballed each of the fancy boys in turn, and he gestured to the Bohan Trace beyond, where the Northside aggregators could be heard to howl their taunts and curses, and he said, "You fucking taking that?" I said, "You gonna fucking well take that, like?" Logan approached the boy and embraced him, and he whispered to him, "Wolfie, I eyed." Yes, and it was Wolfie that blew a short three-noted whistle then, and a great welter of feeling settled that moment on the heartnet fancy. The whistle was a plain melody that rose once and then fell. That was melancholy. That was sourced from the lost time in Bohan. That had a special power to it, a power that I cannot even begin to explain to those of you unfortunate enough not to come from this place. And it was answered, after a silence had a moment held, it was answered in sweet sequence by the fancy, and by this plain music they swore allegiance to the Bohan Trace, and as one they moved to reclaim it. Thanks very much. Thanks.
That was Kevin Berry reading from his 2011 novel, City of Bohan. If you're in New York, you can see him in person on November 16th at the Irish Art Center, where he'll be discussing his latest novel, Beetlebone. For tickets or more information, visit irishartcenter.org.
Thank you for listening to the Live from Irish Art Center podcast, bringing you closer to live Irish arts in New York City. For more information, visit irishartcenter.org.